slightly more complicated because you've got two sentient beings, and you know, you've got a rider that's calibrating, which is fine, but you've also got the horse that's calibrating as well, and it's almost, and it's the dyad is a perfect term because it's absolutely a dyad. Well, driving a car isn't really a dyad.
Yep.
You've got a full person controlling a thing which is perfectly responsive to what you're doing. So it's really, really interesting that, well, and why I always really enjoy these conversations around equestrian sports.
Welcome to the Dynamics Coaching River Tiger podcast. These podcasts are about all things equestrian, especially learning and developing skills for both horses and riders. My name is Marianne Davies, and on this first episode, I am absolutely delighted to be joined by Dr. James Stafford and Warren Lampard to discuss and explore the role of calibration in equestrian sports and activities.
Hello, my name is Dr. James Stafford. I am the business development lead for neurotechnology company Incisive that develops VR tools for elite sports. And my background is that I am an experimental psychologist with a PhD in understanding perception, action, and decision making.
Hi, I'm Warren Lampard. I'm a British eventing master coach, British show jumping level 3 coach, British equestrian level 4 coach. I have a master's degree in coaching science, a bachelor's degree in agricultural science. I'm a keen equestrian competitor, competing internationally in the sport of eventing at 5-star level, and I'm actively show jumping domestically.
Sure, you can think about the calibration side from the rider point of view that, okay, this horse has a different action capabilities than another horse. It can jump higher, it can run faster, blah, blah, blah. But the horse has to get used to the rider as well, and has to calibrate what the rider's doing, the weight of the rider, the intentions of the rider. And I think that's really, really interesting, and something we know very little about as well, is how this dyad works in unison with each other. And it raises interesting questions as to why you get these sort of bonds between riders and horses that are present in some areas and not present in others. And I imagine a lot of that can be broken down to calibration as well, is that you find these horse and rider really well calibrated to each other, and then you've got some others that aren't really calibrated. And so, yeah, it's a really, really interesting area.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it makes super sense. I mean, just like listening to you talk, you know, what sort of struck me is to achieve that calibration, there has to be an interaction.
Yeah.
There does have to be an interaction. On the level of that interaction can change, but my feeling would be there's sort of two systems or two extremes. One is the horse and the rider understand each other and can react to each other. And you know, I saw something recently. One of the course designers the course designer of badminton, and he was saying, in the sports of dressage and show jumping, you can take a high level rider and put them on a high level horse, and they'll more or less be able to go into the arena and jump. So you get lots more transfer of ownership and stuff. Whereas in the sport of eventing at the highest levels, because it is so unpredictable and there's so many other factors involved, then it's very rare to have that relationship that you can just get on and make it happen. So you get that real team thing. And then at the other extreme, you've got it where the horse basically is a psychologist and takes the responsibility of going, okay, and they create circumstances where they get the rider to commit to whatever course of action the rider is going to do about maybe 6 strides off a jump or something. And then the horse goes, okay, I know everything that's going to happen now, and we'll compensate accordingly. And so then if you get someone else on it that actually does a better job, the horse won't believe the rider.
Yeah.
And it, you know, that re-education, re-confidence, all that is, that's another skill set, but just that their ability to operate independently and compensate versus being a real team. And you know, I think that's the joy of high level competition is you're pushing that boundary that you are you really are a team, but you really work off each other. And but it's a you've got to be in balance and everything's got to be working, that there's no extra noise from your technique and everything else. So it really does introduce another level. I don't know if there's any other sport that's quite as complicated, but it's great fun when it works.
I would be interested to see what you think, James, but I don't think there's another sport that's that complicated in terms of like an interception sport, because you've got the horse that's doing the jumping and the horse that is the only one that's aware of its current action capabilities. So that might be everything from fatigue to balance position, etc. Then you've got the horse also having to calibrate for any changes. And that's ground conditions, especially eventing. I mean, I remember one of my early events thing, I'm cantering up to a 1 meter table thinking this looks like a gorgeous stride, and literally two strides out I hit mud and my horse takes a short ride, and I think I probably squealed, I'm pretty sure, because it was just like took off miles away, had no choice. And that's, you know, and then typical of a, you know, just a local event where you haven't got great conditions that you would get in a really good quality, you know, track. But so you've got this, you've got the horse that's actually doing the jumping.
Yeah.
But they're having to also calibrate for the rider, like Warren says. And the rider is the one that's navigating. They know the course. So the rider has to navigate, but that's it for definite. The bit that I find really fascinating, and this is like being completely selfish, is an unpacking. It's probably poor coaching that I've received, is the idea is the riders walk the course, they know what the distances are, so the rider needs to tell the horse what the distances are and tell the horse where to take off. And I'm going, actually, horses are really good at perceiving their environment, and if the rider wasn't on them, they'd be able to judge that information. Because one of the differences between a horse and a human is they're born further down that road of tighter perception action coupling. So they're still going to learn, there's still lots of calibration happening, but it's not as much as a human being. And for me, that's probably a really good and interesting area for research, and probably a rabbit hole that's too bigger to go down. But they still have to recalibrate and recalibrate, and they've still got that ability to do that. You know, so baby horses, young horses will do huge jumps over tiny, tiny obstacles. And as they become more skilled, they calibrate, don't they, Warren, so that they're much more efficient.
I think that just a couple of thoughts on that. The first, like you're describing that riding at that level, and it reminds me of lots of riders, is so it depends on the skill of communication. And I like to think of it as being, you know, you're developing a language, and when you first start, you know, one of you talks German and one of you talks English, and it's finding common grounds, and then you build in words, and then over time you build a vocabulary so you can go around and as a team, then you say one word, and if you understand each other, that one word means sentences, and it everything just slots into place. But lots of riders, and I think this probably fits into the calibration stuff, James, let's see what you think with it. But one of the issues I find is people feel confident with momentum, and they feel committed. And if the horse has enough momentum, just out of pure survival, it will endeavor to jump a fence. So loads of people ride that way. So the easiest way to get a horse to go forwards might be, and one of the other things I like with all this stuff is you can do it on your own, stood still. If you lean forwards and get in front of your balance point, if you then wiggle a little bit, you're going to overbalance. You have to take a step. And you see people doing that on horses all the time. They will then tend to ride a jump in the same fashion that they chase it off the ground. They get in front of the horse and say to the horse, you know, come with me, which is all right at lower levels where you've got a bigger error margin, as you go through the levels, the error margin gets smaller and smaller. So the horse has got to be able to trust you. Now, the other side of that is someone that can feel the horse's brain and its focus and the way it's thinking, which sort of leads into what you were talking about, that decision-making, Marianne, is if you can feel the focus, even though there's nothing happening, you can come out of the equation in a large extent. So you can walk down to a very large fence and the horse off one stride of canter can jump over the fence. Obviously, your technique's got to be good enough that you're not going to interfere. So the horse can stay focused on the question, but you can feel that focus, which is much more of a psychological thing than a physical thing. So riders that can work like that will, in accordance with what you're talking about, Marianne, you know, you can feel your job's almost to manage the ingredients and let the horse jump the fence. So the horse can concentrate on the jump. And in that sense, it's got a greater mental capacity to concentrate on the question and anything that may come as a result of. Whereas if you lack that skill set, then you feel like you need to be more in control and manage the spot. And the horses, whatever you do, as long as it's consistent, the horse will compensate and, generally speaking, do the best job it can. Otherwise, they wouldn't even let us ride them in the first place. And, you know, I often sit there and think, why the hell do they let us even get near them? Because it's stupid. But they do. But when that works, it just works a treat. But it's – so in terms of calibration – I wonder whether that sort of opens up two areas where there's the physical side of it, almost perception and maybe reading a situation and distance. And as you say, you know, how heavy is this person? Are they on it today? Are they a bit slow? Are they a bit out of kilter, whatever? And the same rider to the horse versus the mental calibration and that sort of focus where you are getting on the same wavelength. And if you know that and you can trust that, then you can step out of it and give the horse responsibility for that job and you can concentrate on another job. So question to you then, James, is, you know, is that two distinctly separate things where it's a more physical thing and a more psychological thing, or does that fit all into the same package?
I think they fit into all the same package. And, you know, I think the interesting thing from listening to you, and I think that it's really, really interesting sort of conundrum there as well, Warren, is that, you've sort of, it's kind of like when we say in ecological psychology, you've got like this environment actor system. So you've got these two things that are in unison with each other, but with equestrian sports, it's kind of an actor environment actor system where you've got these two competing actors and you're sharing the same environment, and it's a question of understanding, well, both of you can't lead. So one of you is going to have to take the responsibility of picking up the perceptual information relevant to achieve the task. So, I mean, time to contact is a perfect example for jumping. Yep. You know, it's deciding when is the trigger point to initiate the jump. And as I heard you describing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that can come down to either the rider or the horse. And somebody has to take that decision themselves. And to be honest, both are capable of doing it. You know, like, we know humans can make time to contact judgments, even if it's not directly to the eye. A perfect example of that is braking a car. Like, you've got the entire bonnet and the steering wheel directly in front of you. It doesn't have to be directly to the eye for you to know this is how much I need to stop before I hit an object. So we know humans can do it. But this is something I think ecological sort of camps do a lot better than most other approaches, where they really try to put an organism ahead. We don't say humans, we say organisms, and we do that very intentionally because, you know, I remember meeting with David Lee, who's quite a famous ecological psychologist once, and I was telling him about the stuff, my research in rotocrossing. And I was talking to him a lot about, like, you know, how humans can do this, and it's such a good human skill. And he turned to me and he said, well, do you know dogs can cross the road? And they can do it very, very well. And I was like, you keep saying humans to me, but it's not, like, yep. Humans aren't unique to that task. And I think it's very, very similar for horses as well, is that, you know, there's a famous research with gannets where they're diving to go fishing, and they initiate their wings at a very specific point called a time mark. And the time they initiate their wings is the perfect amount of time to get from the sort of widespread wings down into the diving position where they're sort of back deep inside their body. And horses have this as well, where they'll know what is the specific sort of time remaining. So, like, say, you know, I'm running towards a fence, you know, and it's going 5 seconds, 4 seconds, 3 seconds, 2 seconds. The horse will know exactly at 1.5 seconds, that's when I need to jump to get over a barrier of this height. And the human can do that too. So they can decide, I've been riding this horse, I get a sense of how good it is, I think its time margin is 1.6 seconds. And the horse will know actually it's 1.5, and it's this discrepancy. And it's down to, if it's an inexperienced horse, then maybe it makes sense for the rider to go, you know what, I'm going to take over the reins here. I think I can do a better job at judging this than you. Or if you think it's a very experienced horse, you can go, I actually trust you to make these perceptual decisions. And I think this psychological calibration that you're describing, Warren, is kind of fitting into that, because it's sort of saying, you know your roles, and that I think the horse is really well calibrated, and I think perceptually they're judging these elements really, really well. And sort of it's taking the decision out of your hands, going, you know what, I trust the horse. I trust the horse. I think it's calibrated to its environment. We're sharing the same environment, which is the challenge. So the worst case scenario I can imagine is when both the rider and the horse are trying to make the decisions and together, and that one is they're combating on top of each other, saying, I think it's a 1.6 time margin, or I think it's a 1.5 time margin. And that's where you get mistakes, where you get these sort of falling in between. And there's good research on that as well, where if you think there's an opportunity for action, but it's kind of falling in between the cracks of it's just about possible or it just about isn't. When you find that decisions fall on that manifest,
action boundary.
Yes, that action boundary is the sort of this ecological term. So when you're very, very operating very close to your action boundary, that's when the mistakes creep in. And they did this in a research paper where you had to fit a tennis ball through a hole, and they would give you really, really big holes, and everyone just went, "Yep, pop that through." And then they give you really small ones, and then they went, "Yep, I'm not going to put that through." And suddenly they gave them these holes that were just wider than the ball or just smaller. And what happened was they took way longer to make a decision first off. And when they did make a decision, the movement through was less clean. It was very erratic and jumpy. And this is the danger I imagine with equestrian sports, is that if you're falling in this action boundary area where it's getting close to the limits of the horse or the rider, that's probably when the mistakes creep in. And this is, that's why I say they're related, because that's not actually happening on the action side. It's also happening on the mental side as well. Yeah. We're getting this indecision of, do I go, do I not? Am I taking the decision? Is the horse taking the decision? So that's my take. I mean, I'm not in equestrian sports. I'm quite naive to all of that, but that would be my hunch.
I think it's quite interesting. I think something that to throw into that, and I sort of mentioned it, but is it's throwing in the horse or the rider's mental capacity. So a horse with limited communication skills or language skills, same as a kid, child, you know, you as a rider feel like you've done your job because you've explained it and you've told the horse what to do. And the horse is there going, I don't understand what you were talking about. And then with a younger horse Marianne, the stuff you're working on, when you throw environment and everything else into it, and as a flight animal, and I would argue more so with mares than with geldings or stallions, they've got to be aware of their environment. So in that situation where they're feeling challenged, you then throw in all of that looking at everything else and not actually focusing on the question. So, you know, already that mental capacity is possibly at 80%. You then throw a rider in that trying to tell the horse what to do in a language that the horse doesn't understand.
Yeah, and a rider who may not actually be well calibrated. I think that is
completely
true, isn't it? That
and the calibre, even sorry, even if they are,
yeah,
the calibration's got to go out because when the horse starts to not understand, it will start to run.
Yeah,
which is where a lot of riders would then perhaps become more physical and increase their control element, be it with a stronger bridle or you know, stronger whip or whatever. And the, again, the horse doesn't understand it. So then it wants to run even more and the brain's way beyond, there's nothing left.
Yeah.
And then you've got a rider that's reacting to feeling like, oh my God, nothing's working here, panic. Whereas a more experienced rider in those situations, again, the same, someone that's good with working kids and with kids and everything, it's, you know, it's making it simpler. But I then take that argument at the highest levels. It's all those complicated tasks, those calibrations are intrinsic because of your training.
Yeah.
And you're not thinking about it. And ultimately that's what choking is, isn't it? When you know everyone starts to try and do it consciously because they're trying too hard. And that difficulty with training, because those processes take time.
Yeah.
And those, so presumably, again, question, if you haven't taken the time, not if you haven't taken the time, if those skills, in muscle memory, let's call them muscle, if those muscle memory skill sets haven't been developed, then you can't even do the calibration because the reactions aren't there. So presumably goalkeeping's a lot like this. Until you learn the skills, you know, you can't calibrate to a certain question that you might get at premier level because the skills aren't there to deal with it, let alone the speed.
Yeah, it's a very valid point. And the sort of scientific term for that is something called a rate limiter. Mm-hmm. So it means to achieve a certain skill, you need to have sort of a strong baseline level of all the sort of fundamental components below that. So, yeah. I mean, shooting in football is a good example where to shoot in football, you need to raise one the kicking leg and follow through onto the ball, but you've got your non-kicking leg, which is used to stabilize the body. So the non-kicking leg, and if you actually look at research into expertise in ball striking in football, all the best, the most accurate shot takers, the most accurate passers have really, really high stability on their supporting leg. Everyone obsesses with, are you a right-footed player or are you a left-footed player? But actually, it's the stability of the leg that's holding you still while you kick. That is the important bit. And it's related to your point, Warren, is that, you know, if it's a be it horse or be it rider, is that if they're missing those fundamental skills or they haven't got to a certain extent, I guess, of, I don't know what those skills are, you'll be able to say better than me. But if they aren't achieved, then it's very difficult to get beyond that because you haven't got that baseline level yet. Mm. So these things around calibration and stuff, that's kind of come to, calibration comes in once you've got all the necessary equipment for that. And I think I talked about this on podcast with Marianne with UK coaching as well, is that, you know, if you're, you know, throwing a Frisbee, for example, and you're trying to catch a Frisbee, is that it's all fine and well knowing it takes me 1.5 seconds to do that reaching action to grab it. But if I can't accurately tell when the Frisbee is going to reach me, knowing that it takes me 1.5 seconds to grab something is totally irrelevant, you know, because I don't know when the Frisbee's actually going to get to me. So that skill after the fact is kind of not useful. And I think that's related to this point around, you know, when you've got a horse or a rider that hasn't got that necessary level of expertise, is that that's acting as a rate limiter to get that's stopping you from getting to that next level of understanding the dyad better, I guess.
Completely. And it is interesting because then there's various ways of compensating for that, and that a horse being a conscious animal does seem to take on a level of responsibility. I love the balance over the foot stuff is just brilliant because I think it's like one of the biggest issues in equestrianism is the rider's ability to balance over the foot. And one of the the biggest issues I see is because we sit on our bums, lots of saddle manufacturers build saddles that are very comfortable and quite secure, that makes a rider feel comfortable and safe. But probably the best gear, if you and the most skilled people are the racing jockeys, because they're in these little pads with just a single stirrup. And the one of the things I see a lot of is the balance over the foot, that as a skill in itself, and a lot of really good riders, when they're in trouble, effectively stand up rather than sit down. You know, then you can operate all parts of your body independently. And that's the really difficult thing, is everything has, you know, it's more than rub your tummy and pat your head. It's six other things at the same time.
Yeah.
Plus, but the same for the horse. The horse's ability to balance over its foot and use its legs properly. So a really talented rider, if you can imagine, there's perhaps two operating systems, and the simplest would be it goes in a straight line and it goes faster and slower. And in a sense, the advantage of that would be the four legs are almost, and horses are very good at doing this, we use the term, like they make like a billiard table. They effectively spread out to try and manage us on top. And what they're very good at doing is sort of then getting a little bit of momentum and pulling legs out of the way, and they might jump front half, back half, and the front half lifts and the back half lifts. Then, but that's a straight line. But if you put a bend in the horse's body, then as the horse is turning, say it's bending to the right hind leg will step under the middle of the horse. And as the body travels over the horse, then that leg effectively carries the weight, lifts the body, steps up into the bridle. But the balance point becomes a lot smaller. So it's like a ballet dancer on toes,
yeah,
versus a rugby prop stood there on 2 feet and very close to the ground. So that dynamic movement that relies on, again, the idea of an intrinsic sense of balance over your feet and how to move your body to maintain that, or if you feel like you're getting out of balance, how to get back in balance, versus I'm feeling challenged by the situation, so I'm going to sit down so I feel secure. But in doing that, you squash the horse and you take away the horse's ability to operate independently, because now it's got to deal with you, manage you, and manage the situation.
Yeah.
But yeah, the balance over the feet stuff is, and it's really interesting, like from my point of view as a coach, because a lot of people, when you've got a horse that's then fighting you when it wants to run, the natural thing then is you drive the heel and create a leverage point that you sit behind. And the security of being able to do that is, again, knowing that you can sit.
Yeah.
But you're behind your foot. So if you are then going to jump before the horse takes off, so in that last stride, you've actually got to commit with your upper body to get over that balance point before the horse takes off, whereas someone that's balanced over the foot can stay until the horse actually comes off the floor. And that's great if you time it, but if you mistime it, or the horse goes, oh, now you're over my shoulder, I'm struggling to get up, then they've what they learn to do is rapidly decelerate to then sneak over the fence or accelerate off the ground to do a long jump. But yeah, that's all stuff they've got to learn, and it makes it infinitely more complicated, but in a possibly a negative way, what's a good way to put it? Level limiting way.
Yeah.
Whereas at the highest levels in any sport, you know, it's infinitely more complicated than normal people can get their heads around. But you need that skill set.
And it's really interesting, and it's something I wish I was able to do more research on. Time and constraints that meant I couldn't. But the way I'm conceptualizing this in my head, as you describe it, Warren, is like you've got the horse's center of gravity, which is like a point in space. So it's like as the horse is moving and turning, that center of gravity is moving about left, right, center. And there come with all of our center of gravity, it can move up until you get to a tipping point, you know? And so it's like, you know, as you were describing earlier, it's like you can stand up on a straight posture and you can slowly start to lean your body forward. Eventually there's this tipping point with the center of gravity where it's moved too far forward and you can't support your weight anymore.
Yep.
And There is research on this. It's actually not very well known, which is a real shame, but there is research on human sensitivity to, it's called time to topple, or basically you can feel this center of gravity, be it through your hands or your body, you can be sensitive to that change. So there's a researcher called Patrick Cave who's done research in this. It's really, really interesting. And the example he gives is in the US, I think in particular, there's a lot of fatalities every year of people shaking vending machines. So they're shaking it back and forth, trying to get a packet of crisps or whatever to fall out. And
more dangerous than staff attacks, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. And
I remember it.
And they are trying to be sensitive to how much they can shake it without pushing it over its limits. And you can imagine with the vending machine, the center of gravity is moving like this. And they because they're not attuned to it, they're not sensitive to its properties. They shake it too much and they tip it past its tipping point, and that's how it falls. Mm-hmm. And there's research on this with tractor drivers actually. And it was when you were talking about the saddles and being close to the horse, I thought that was really, really interesting. Where when you're a tractor driver and you're on a really uneven fields, you need to be sensitive to how much that tractor suspension is bouncing side to side. Yep. And tractor drivers are really sensitive to the tractor's center of gravity, and they know how much to push it on these hills before you're tipping it towards its tipping point. Yep. And I think it sounds like it's the same with riders, where talking about calibration is that it's actually a property of the horse. The horse environment interaction that they need to be sensitive to is they need to learn to pick up, probably through the waist and the legs, and probably the upper body as well, probably transfer through. They need to be sensitive to how this horse is changing side to side, and they need to know the sort of action boundaries or the point of tipping of that horse. And it's when you're coming into these bends on the turn, it's like, how much can I push the horse on a certain angle before I think I'm pushing the inertia too far and you're tipping it past? So it's actually something that would be really interesting to do some work on, is this sensitivity to this center of gravity of a horse.
I've got a little story about this, I think, which blew my mind when I did it. So when I was at Heartbreak the first year, I went and joined the polo club, you know, playing horse polo. And the first session I had on the polo horse was incredible. So I really enjoyed it, because it was very similar to, it seemed very similar to canoe paddling. You know, we have to sort of move your whole body so that you can get that sort of sweep that follows parallel to the horse's body. It didn't take me very long to realize that as I was swinging polo mallet, my pony would slow down or speed up. And it was doing that before I either hit or missed the ball. So my pony knew before I actually made contact. So I was like, "Snoopy, quiet." I was like, "This is outrageous." The other thing that was really fascinating was I was literally hanging over the side of the pony in order to be able to swing the mallet. And yet it still went in a perfect straight line. You know, and I've ridden dressage horses where you fart and they change direction. I'm like this. So the pony had learned what information to ignore and what information to be attuned to.
But that's worth money to people, because in polo, if you make someone feel safe who has lots of money, then they spend all the money in your direction. So you train the horse to go straight and then it slows down and turns around.
I just followed the ball. If I was going to miss it, it was getting ready to spin round and go back. And if my pony knew I was going to hit it, it was already accelerating to follow the ball. And then at one point, the bit that really blew my mind was at one point, my mallet started swinging back up and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to hit this pony in the face. And my pony literally just moved its head nonchalantly to the side and then just put it back again. I was like, I feel so humiliated. I just did knows. It's so attuned to that information.
And you think from the horse's perspective, like how little that probably feels to them, like that's probably on, in terms of the haptic system of the horse, that probably doesn't feel like much, but they just learned that very subtle change in weight or inertia means this. And you know, expertise in animals is fascinating. It's so
we're learning stuff when we're not aware, you know. My, like, people say, oh, your dog knows you're going to take it for a walk, And it's like, it's the tiny things. You go and get your keys, you pick up a certain coat or something. And I mean, I remember watching a horse that had, that his rider had fallen off early in the course. It was, you know, it was a not fairly novice. And the horse carried on jumping. But the bit that was fascinating was that it carried on jumping a course that looked like a normal jumping course. It was probably all in the right order, because the curves and the shapes actually have quite a pattern that the horses were picking up. You know, it was just like, wow,
I think the center of mass or the balance point thing is you can feel, I believe, your sense, your balance point relative to the horse's balance point.
Yeah.
So when they're coming slightly out of sync, you know, and you can move. Maybe what's interesting with the animals is they're much more. So one of the things I do with a lot of riders, not a lot, because I have to be careful, but I think one of the problems a lot of riders have is they make their decision-making is based on what they see, and they aren't feeling what's happening. And most of what's important, they can't see. So if a horse comes out of balance, it pops its head up.
Yeah.
And they think, oh my God, it's got its head up, I've got to get its head down. But the fact is, it's out of balance. It'll fix itself. It needs to be able to use its neck. And I just wonder, on the back end of that conversation, that, you know, dogs, horses, whatever, they can't have a conversation with us. And naturally, they're much more attuned to their environment than we are.
Yeah.
And one of the problems with riders, with riding, and I suspect it fits into this whole calibration idea, is, you know, again, you've got to take away those stimuli that we find easy,
yeah,
and that we rely on because we're a bit lazy,
yeah,
and perhaps be a little bit or become more animalistic and really start to be more aware of our environment. And, you know, again, with like some of the work you're doing, Marianne, of if you'd become more aware of that, then you're seeing the things that maybe the animal's seeing. And I know a lot of riders get frustrated where, you know, from our mind, it seems really simple.
Yeah.
And as a coach with a student, it's like, well, but I've explained it to you. You know, this is really easy. Come on, do it. And they're sitting there.
Can we explain affordances here? Is it worth just exploring what an affordance is and whether a horse sees an affordance? Or is that a rabbit hole?
Oh, affordances are unfortunately always a rabbit hole, but to break an affordance down into its most basic principle is that it's an opportunity for action based. So it's an opportunity of action specific to the actor environment interaction. So
a moment in time.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, for example, I'll use the road crossing example. That's sort of my default example, is that, you know, I can cross the road. So let's say I can cross the road in 3 seconds. Okay. So if there's a gap in the car between the two cars that are coming towards me, that takes 4 seconds to close. I can cross the road in 3 seconds. That's an affordance for me because I have a 1 second margin to safely get across. Suddenly, if you have a kid or an older adult and they take 5 seconds to cross the road and the gap between the cars is still 4 seconds, that's not an affordance for them because it's not safe for them to actually get across in time. So that's why with affordances, it's always specific to that environment. So in this example, the environment is the cars, the gap between the cars.
And if you're giving the actor, piggyback, for example, you're giving a friend a piggyback, your affordance is going to change and you need to calibrate to it. Or if you're drunk or you're very tired, or, you know, anything else, there's lots of other things, and at that moment in time that affordance stops existing for you.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, it's the classic example I always give is that, say, okay, I can cross the road in 3 seconds. What if you put a heavy backpack on me? Can I still cross the road in 3 seconds? No, I can't. And then suddenly the affordance goes away because my action capabilities have changed. So that in its most basic principle is an affordance. And an affordance for equestrian sports gets complicated because you have an affordance of a rider, you have an affordance of a horse, and you're both sharing the same environment. And this is where I think this is really interesting, is that it's back to what I was saying earlier, you almost have, instead of this environment actor dyad, you've got this actor environment actor dyad, sort of triad, and it's it's adding a level of complexity which most other domains don't have to worry about. And this is where it opens up a lot of questions, interesting questions around skill acquisition, because you've got two things trying to learn at the same time, and their rates of learning might be different as well, and you've got that whole challenge to deal with. So it's very, very complicated, but interesting.
Thwarting the rider could be a rate limiter. Beginner rider could be a rate limiter to a horse learning, and vice versa.
Yeah,
not only beginner, right through. It just depends. It depends on, I believe it depends on skill set, and it depends on your riding mode, riding style, as to, you know, how that animal's produced, and you know, but like a high level rider that's experienced will, from the moment that horse is started, know where they're trying to go with it. And so they're, you know, the same, anyone that's developing people, whatever, you know, if you know where you're trying to get them, not just visually, but what it feels like and everything else, then you'll recognize moments at the earliest stage, and you're creating that operating system that allows them to operate at the highest levels.
This Warren gets to a crux actually for me that I think would be really interesting to unpack, and that's that. And again, it's like the, you know, you talked about actually sometimes the human can be the one that makes the decisions. Is that like the parent helping the child crossing the road, though? If the human's making the decisions, is the horse learning to judge time to contact? And is there potentially an issue if a human makes a mistake down the road? But also, even though you know where they're going, does that horse rider dyad need to have the opportunity to solve multiple problems and have a broader selection of solutions as they move up? They're going to have less. I could see Warren smiling. They're clearly going to have less when they're higher up, because there are less solutions that will work once you get to the highest point of your ability. But if I think about, you know, popping over easy jumps, and I think eventers do this really well actually. They'll let the horse, you know, walk over and pop it, or trot over and do it. They'll do different angles, different directions, different speeds and things, so that the horse is actually then got a chance. If it's not on the perfect stride and the perfect line, in reality it can get back there. The rider can get back there. They've been there before, they've explored that perceptual motor workspace. Whereas and again, because you know where you're going, whereas if you just try and rote repetition a perfect solution, does that mean that you then don't have that adaptive system and you're not able to adjust and problem solve within a moment and get yourself out of sticky situations that you've ended up in? I mean, I was at Wells and West this weekend, and one class I was watching that had somebody I was doing data collection for, first of all, somebody fell off and it was quite serious, so it stopped everything for ages, and then all that warmth decrement and their stress and everything. Then the menage grader turned up in the arena next door and started flattening the surface again, and I'm like, that's not something that you can practice for if you're trying to do it perfectly.
Well, you know, there's a huge question, like, what is perfect?
Yeah.
Because I would argue that as you go through the levels, you have a course designer and competitors that are actively trying to test your skill set at that level.
Yeah, and the course designer is trying to trick, or it's trying to trip you up, isn't it?
They're testing your skill set. I think that's, it's important to look at it from that perspective. Yes. And it's a really fine line to walk.
Yeah.
Because it especially at the high, well, you've got a huge dilemma in creating courses, because if you create a course that challenges a rider and the same as a rider developing a horse, then that horse or rider is going to be out of their comfort zone, because it's going to be a question that they're not quite ready for yet, or it's going to be something they haven't done before. But in doing it, it then creates the stimuli to learn and develop and build that skill set. But it does mean, so there's two things that become important in my opinion on it. One is problem solving. And certainly for eventing, and my personal feeling is, you know, I want to develop a horse that is confident to problem solve. And in that effect, my job is to make sure that the ingredients are right, that the horse can deal with the equation. So there's problem solving. The other one that's massive in this, and if you consider the physics of what we do, it doesn't make sense. We're sat on 600 kilos. We're traveling at pace. We're 8, 9, 10 foot off the floor. You know, that's death defying. You know, if that doesn't work, people die. That's the nature of it. And in this day and age, if someone proposed the sport now on health and safety grounds, it wouldn't be allowed. Yeah. I don't think. No. So it's a rider's and a horse's confidence to go outside their comfort zone and develop versus their need to feel confident and safe. And that, you know, you get one scenario you would see quite regularly is it's usually a male, but in my experience, I'll say it's usually a male, but it'll be someone that's quite physically talented, enjoys the challenge, gets a bit exciting, has a bit of success because they've got a good sense of balance or whatever, and they progress quite quickly. But those inherent skills or ability to recognize environment, ability, one of the things I see a lot is it's the ability to anticipate what might be about to happen that hasn't happened yet. So you know, anyone that's good at what they do sees an accident before it happens and is already ready for it. And I see loads of riders that they come down and this is so maybe to make a perfect rider, you've got to introduce chaos because it's anticipating when it's not going to work and being there ready to help and support the horse as opposed to I'm being perfect and suddenly, oh my God, it's not perfect. Now I've got to get back in the picture and the horse is trying to deal with this and you and everything else. So that experience in reading situations, reading the environment, you can alter your position, you can alter the canter, you can alter, you know, whatever you need to. The horse's trust in you that and that communication set that when that happens, you can keep talking to each other. And you're not screaming, you're just using simple words. I would say the same in elite sport, probably military situations. Basically, it's a relationship. You know, anyone with your spouse or partner, you know, one raised eyebrow, you know that means a heap of stuff. And it's that same thing, yet to explain what that means to someone else, you're going to be there for half a day. So all those things come into it. And it's just a huge dilemma for the sport because it's developing people and developing horses so they feel safe. But if you challenge them and they're not of that mindset where they're comfortable, and often I find it's as much that they're comfortable in themselves. So often it may be something else is happening in their life that's really not good. So they don't have the capacity to go outside their comfort zone. There's that trust and rapport and everything else that you know, they might go. But it's the same with a horse. I've had it several times where I thought, okay, this is a really crap situation. This is really bad. And you, through that relationship, you put yourself in a position where hopefully you're not going to interfere and that horse is disagree with my decision making and made the right choice, or out of a situation where I just think this is impossible, it finds a solution, and that's the joy of the sport is that something else steps in. But there's team sport, isn't it? You know, some you're playing. I mean, I used to play Australian rules, and it's rugby, whatever the same. I'm sure it's someone else reading the same situation. Sees it from a different perspective, you're seeing what you see, they identify an opportunity and they come in and support you. And you know, now it's a team situation because you've helped each other out. So it's that involves a level of trust that lots of people struggle with, especially when they're feeling not in control of a situation themselves. It's really complicated.
And, you know, I think that's a really, really good point. And, you know, when you could, it's talking about affordances earlier, there's a quite a bit good, big piece of research on how accidents happen. And basically they try to summarize accidents as they have a line, which I like. It's that the misactualization of affordances. And what that really means is you're taking on opportunities that aren't actually there. And the interesting thing about it is, because you're talking about course designers, and this is kind of what course designers are doing, is that they're building the environment. So they're building opportunities for action for the rider horse dyad. And it's like what you're saying, Warren, it's a fine line with a lot of it, in that a good course designer should know basically the limits of what an affordance would be for a specific horse, a specific type of horse. And you know, like one of the things that's well documented with accidents with children is in where there's apartment buildings with balconies, is that barriers to balconies, is that there's a specific height ratio between the child and the barrier where it's just about climbable, which means it creates this opportunity to climb, which the child will then take. And then because it's so such an inviting thing for the child to do, they want to climb it. And then that's ultimately what happens, is they fall out of the building because they've created this specific height, which just sort of invites that action. And basically it's the same with like a horse or a rider, is that there's a certain height of barrier or jump that it looks inviting. And it's still like, this is an opportunity to make a jump. And maybe it's just pushing the horse or the rider to their limits. And it's where this trust kind of comes in, is that, and my hunch is that I would always lean towards the horse making the decision, but maybe for a more inexperienced horse, it makes more sense for the rider to do it. But at some point you may feel the horse, actually, this horse is going to take this on, and it's not right that this horse is going to attempt this, or the inverse, where the horse is feeling like the rider's pushing me to do this, and I do not feel like I am capable of making this jump. And that's where the course designer ultimately has got this responsibility, is that whatever course you set up, you're creating opportunities, and that's great. You're creating opportunities for learning, but you're also creating hazards in a way. It's fine. It's walking a very fine line between those two things. Mm-hmm. You're creating these invitations, but are they safe? And that's where the trust has to, for me, that's where this trust has to, that's where it's most important, is that, you know, this opportunity for action, are you taking it? And if you're not taking it, then that decision needs to happen quicker. And it's back to what we're saying about operating in the action boundary. We know when it's close to your limits, whatever decision you take, it takes longer. So that's where I imagine the experience comes in a lot more as well, is if you can make those decisions faster, either the horse or the rider, it doesn't matter which one.
And in that sense, if you're anticipating it with the experience, you've made that, you instead of waiting till the problems happen, you've solved a small problem and you've corrected something before it happens.
Yeah.
And you know, you're already there. I think the affordances idea is really relevant in what we do, and you know, they say, I remember skiing, and you know, you finish a day fantastically and you think unreal, and you come out the next day and your brain's still there, but your body's not. And you just go bloomf, and it's like, where the hell did that come from? And I think, you know, from a riding perspective, people understanding that process more, and that's, for me, it's something that I've incorporated into my coaching, just listening to the podcast on the calibration stuff, is, you know, you've got to respect that. And people have a tendency to get down on themselves because, like, oh, I'm not, you know, this isn't working, I'm not doing a very good job, I'm not right. And it's like, no, you're not in sync, you haven't recognized where you're at, and you haven't gone through that checklist of making sure things are working and building yourself back up to that point. And that, I think that's massive for our sport, massive.
I agree, and I think it's definitely with expectations. You know, people think, well, my horse jumped that yesterday, and well, today it's tired, it's got DOMS, and you know, it's been overstimulated, and or it, you know, it's upset. What happened yesterday is completely different to what's happening at this moment in time, and an affordance that was there. You know, I think about it. I found it was really good for me to think about my work as a mountain guide, and within mountain rescue. And there was a, you know, there's a big jump that I used to cross. If the weather was nice and it was dry and still, and I had trainers on and I wasn't carrying a rucksack, I could jump over this. But any of those things changed, I would move further up and I'd go off the path and I'd find a smaller, because it was quite a deep ravine with streaming. So if it was icy or wet or slippy, or I had a big rucksack, or I was carrying, you know, like a stretcher and an oxygen tank, it was like that affordance doesn't exist anymore. It just is not there. Or I've got crampons on, you know, and rigid boots. That affordance doesn't exist anymore. So it's not something static. And that for me was a really good way to think about it.
Is that, I would assume, one of the issues in that sort of environment particularly, and the same with us, is it's respecting that those factors. So firstly, understanding them.
The different surface, the soft surface that saps the horse's energy.
And, you know, I just, you know, again, with all this stuff, I think, like, one of the hard things for our industry, it's probably any sport or all sorts of things, but, you know, you've got people are hugely passionate about it.
Yeah.
And all this stuff is important, but, you know, there's so much energy goes into and resources goes into just keeping them.
Yeah, yeah.
Let alone the rest of it. The understanding's really important, but again, you know, if you're just pushing yourself to build your skill set, then a lot of this stuff goes by the way. And you know, this is where it probably does come into Coach Ed and stuff, because, you know, I find with a lot of students, if you can help them understand the processes, then they're not as hard on themselves. So from my perspective, one of the big ones I use would be a learning cycle. You know, it's all right. Everyone goes, oh, I did it wrong again. It was crap. I did it wrong again. It's like, actually, that's really good, because you're recognizing it and you'll go home and you think about it. And that bit that you got it right.
And mistakes are so important, because mistakes are information for us, aren't they?
Yeah. And I think that's also the mistake thing's important from the horse point of view, because you've got to allow. So a lot of people, I think, struggle with letting a horse make a mistake. And they feel like something's wrong, and they'll turn around and look at you and go, oh my God, why did it do that? And you go, well, come around and do it again. And it might change what it does. And then it does it three times. And the third time it does it perfectly. But it's giving it that opportunity to learn. And one of the issues in this country is where there's so many opportunities to compete, you feel like you've got to go and compete. But a lot of people, I would argue, struggle to take enough time to let the horse make mistakes and do its own skill acquisition work. So that repetition and try and but again, this stuff, just that working out their affordances in different ground conditions, different states of physical being, tiredness, etc., light, us being a bit out of it, all that stuff. You know, that really does, I believe, need to be factored into the training. But where we've got the opportunity to compete so much, then that can be a real quandary to sort of step back and go, actually, I don't need to do it as much as that, especially with social media and stuff, because it's like, well, everyone else is going brilliantly, so I must be doing something wrong. So it's that clarity of what works for you, when you need to be producing the goods, and what do you need to be able to do that job properly. But it's the confidence then to be able to step back from what everyone else is doing and do what's best for you and for the horse, which comes from making your own mistakes and getting it wrong.
Yeah, I think it's another, I think, quite unique challenge to the sport, I think, in what's defined as a mistake in particular when you're learning. And it's like what we're talking about with calibration, is that because it operates on such short time scales, is that your definition of a mistake to you, the rider, might not be a definition of a mistake to the horse, in that, you know, this horse made this jump yesterday, it didn't make it today, the horse made a mistake. Well, actually, maybe the horse for that day wasn't, that affordance wasn't available to them. So actually, by the horse's standards, that is a successful decision, but you're defining it as a mistake. And I think sometimes, especially, like, I think this is important for Coach Ed in particular, is that the obsession over binary, that was successful, that wasn't successful, it doesn't mean much at that stage. I mean, if the goal is getting better, then whatever they do is feedback. I mean, we know from literature that people get better just by doing things. Like, whether there's structure to it or not, people just get better at it. And, you know, it's this obsession over mistakes and successes, and how many mistakes, the ratio of mistakes to successes as a definition of whether it's a good horse or not, or if it's a good rider or not. To me, it's over-egged. There's too much importance placed on it. That's why I say it's a challenge for horses, because if you could just ask the horse, did you think that was the right decision? That would be great, and you could learn a lot from it. But that's probably, I imagine, the skill of a good coach in equestrian sports, is having a read of the horse and having an understanding of why they took the decision they made. And I just think that's an important thing around the semantics of coaching and learning, is that this binary mistake or success really doesn't mean much, because especially for equestrian sports, where you don't really understand fully the process of the decision-making process of the horse as well.
Just sort of quickly there, I think there's two important points for me out of that, and it refers to stuff I think you're talking about, Marianne, is, you know, this idea of a linear progression. Everyone thinks, well, I've done this, so therefore I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to do that, and there's no foundation to it. And you know, same as anything, when it does go wrong, it collapses. But there's a lot of stuff now on databases, and so this, and even in equestrian, a horse that appears to not make a mistake on its record is worth a lot more money than one that appears to have made mistakes.
Yeah.
And you know, to me, if you want something to go through the levels, you've got to allow it to make lots of mistakes early.
Yeah.
Otherwise you're in trouble later on, because and if you protect it from those, then you've got an issue. But if that animal has to have a value, a commercial value, then you've got to protect it. And then you sell it to an amateur.
Yeah.
And for lots of money, who doesn't have the skill set either.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, then everyone's tearing their hair out because they've spent a heap of money and the job's not worth. I mean, I've had people say to me, you know, I spent a large amount of money on the horse, it should just do it.
They think you've got a spec, don't they? I remember somebody saying to me, I spent 25 grand on a dressage horse, and then they went, it was kind of worth it for the 5 days, it was still a 25 grand horse. And then because the horse is recalibrating to the environment.
As a rider, just a thought, you know, as a rider, like, one of the balances I've got to make if I get on a horse to effectively, say, recalibrate the horse, is if I get that right and the horse starts to believe in that again,
and you give it back to someone else,
then I give it back to the rider.
Yeah.
Then suddenly the horse is open to being even more confused, and then they hurt themselves or get a scare. Yeah. So that balance on, you know, because that is, again, it's worth money. If someone sends a horse to you for 2 weeks and you get it feeling wonderful and they sit on it for 2 days and go, this is great.
Yeah.
You get paid for it, but at the same time, you may not be doing the right thing in terms of the development of that dyad itself. But again, a lot of people then struggle with that because they don't feel comfortable because it's not working. So I think one of the biggest things in all of this is people's confidence in, if it doesn't feel like it's working, that's necessary. And you are, what you were talking about, James, you are actually progressing. You're learning. Your body's training itself. Your horse is training itself. That operating system is coming into being almost. So then it can sort of develop from there. But if you don't trust that process and you're not supported in that process, then you'll step away from it. But I've heard the same of, there's a cultural, the difference between, say, football in this country and maybe football in Brazil or somewhere like that, where if you make a mistake and the team loses as a kid, then you're almost in trouble. So you're encouraged not to make a mistake, and that limits the... Whereas down, in other countries where it's like, well, through necessity, you're just playing, which is a point you made earlier, James. You're just playing. Well, you make a mistake, you keep playing, and you work it out, you try stuff. I see it a lot where you're almost... I think one of the things with riding is you almost got to dare yourself to have a go at something. It's like, I'm not sure if I can, but I'm going to have a go to find out. And it's that confidence in an environment that allows you to do that sort of stuff, I think. It's a huge dilemma.
Yeah, it is a dilemma, because people then get really overprotective over not injuring the horses, don't they? And it's like having that boundary where you mistakes that are not going to be fatal.
But again, there's another thing for it.
There's
a
dilemma.
If you protect it and its body doesn't work right,
then it will be.
You're going to create injuries.
You're creating it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We create injuries. James, I'm aware that we've been talking for ages and we've taken up so much of your time ranting about horses, which clearly Warren and I could do for like weeks on end without stopping. One of the things I'm thinking about, and I've got no idea whether this would be possible, I'm just like, we have these, I mean, I remember when I started at Heartbrain, we've got these, they're not mechanical horses, I'm not allowed to call them that, they're riding simulators. And I was like, but that doesn't respond to you as a rider, it just carries on doing the same thing. That's not, I want to look at this from an ecological perspective. I know they're lovely, it's great fun, but actually that's not going to work for me. But I am also thinking it would be really fascinating to be able to program one and have something like you're in stuff that you do.
I sat on that and I found it very interesting because it didn't do what I wanted it to do.
It's not going forwards. It's not going forwards. So the thing that people struggle with riding, which is staying in balance with forward momentum. So they go, for example, they go up or they stand on their stirrup and the horse moves away from them. Then they fall over backwards. Mm. Like, James, I don't know if you've seen like hikers, beginner skiers, surfing, stuff like that. So generally what tends to happen is people lean back and then, the skis run out in front of you, the surfboard runs out in front of you, the kayak runs out in front of you. Horses are actually quite nice. They tend to try and catch us, but we get the same situation.
I just very quickly, one of the things I've noticed and I like, a lot of the young ladies I coach do play lacrosse.
Okay.
And I do find if they're being physically challenged in a sport environment, someone else is trying to knock them out of balance.
Yeah.
They're having to concentrate on something else.
Yeah, yeah.
They're actually building a really good skill set for riding.
Yeah. I'm also wondering, James, trying to tap into the stuff that you do. Do you think that maybe in the future there would be a way of having some kind of virtual reality that gets riders to pick up that perceptual information as well? And I love the how your horse jumps thing that you gave Warren for me to have a look at. But I was really mindful that it focuses very much on the physiology
yeah.
and what the horse was doing, and not on perception or decision making or calibrating to information. The only mention of that was that the horse needs to lift its head up in order to see.
Yep.
And that, so again, there's a real imbalance at the moment, which is what I'm trying to focus on in my PhD, is go, hang on a minute, there's movement, but there's also perception.
Yes.
At least open that box a little bit and acknowledge that movement doesn't happen, outside of an environment and perceptual information.
It's a very dangerous area. And people, the problem, and this is the problem of all performance technologies, or most, where usually what happens when somebody builds something like a simulator or a performance tech is they'll say, I think this is a really good idea of this isolated skill that I want people to get better at. So I'm going to go and engineer something, which I think replicates the skill. and then I'll get people to try it. And the problem is that that does more harm than it does good. And I think it's an interesting parallel between what Warren was saying, between you've got something which is not responding to you. So it's a riding simulator where it's doing its own thing. And then you've got something like lacrosse, which seems quite far removed from equestrian sports. But the difference is that with lacrosse, you're learning to stabilize balance, which is a really transferable skill to equestrian sport. But when you've got a simulator that is dictating the movements for you, that's not replicating the skill. That's the opposite of what you want it to do. And there's actually good research on this with in cricket and baseball. There's a system called the Pro Batter. And what it is it's for batting batters, and they're facing this ball launcher machine. And they thought, right, let's make this ball launching machine really realistic. So you've got the fixed hole, and then what they did is they put a video of a bowler coming in bowling, and then the 2D representation, then the ball shot out. And the problem with it is that that's not representative of the perceptual information that a batter uses in real life. They use depth perception. They use the position of the wrist, the position of the hand relative to the ball. That's the information they use to decide where I'm going to play the shot, how I'm going to play it. So it may look like it's replicating the skill, but it's actually doing the opposite, because there was research. Exactly. Yeah. And there was research that compared the three. So it took a real bowler, it took a bowling machine, and it took the pro batter. And they found consistently that the pro batter meant the shot execution was poor. They were making worse decisions. And it's because the bowler obviously is the real skill, and that's perfectly replicated. The bowling machine, it takes away that information. It doesn't try to replace it. So you still can do the action without that information present. And then the pro batter is giving you information, but it's false information. No. And that's the problem.
No, isn't it? Information that you then tune into that's not actually specifying.
And that's my concern with things like riding simulators, is it's giving you non-specifying information or false information of how to do these skills, and it's doing more harm than good to the rider. So to answer your question about virtual reality, is that yes, it definitely could do something like that. But the point is, and you made the point, Marianne, is that it has to be coupled to what the saddle is doing. So whatever you see in front of you has to be corresponding to what the saddle is doing as well. And it's keeping that perception action loop coupled. There was a famous example very recently. It was the last, not the Winter Olympics that just passed, but the one before that. And they gave one of the top Olympic female skiers a simulator. And what they did is they record somebody going down the slopes before she goes out to do it. And then it's like, right, she'll be super familiar with the slopes. She'll know where the turns are. But the problem is she practiced this over and over and over again, but it was somebody else skiing. And so it's somebody else's action capability, somebody else's affordances. So when she went onto the slope, she was expected to win gold. When she went out into the slope, she was taking on the affordances of the person she was watching rather than the affordances of her own self. Yeah. And I can't remember if she crashed out or she just recorded a really bad time. It was one of the two. Either way, she drastically underwhelmed on the performance. And the thing that struck me after she came out was she said the turns came really fast. And it just said to me, it's like the turns came fast because the person you were watching took them fast. And then you tried to take on that person, do what they did. And that's always the danger with any of these kind of equipments, is that you need to, as a coach or as a rider, you need to make the judgment of, is this replicating the skill? And if it's not replicating the skill to an adequate level, I would recommend don't even do it. Like, you know, even if it captures a little bit of the skill, just don't do it, because it's going to teach you bad habits that will transfer. Like we always talk about positive transfer, this is negative transfer. It's that you're bringing your bad habits to the performance environment, which is a real danger.
Okay, so potentially Warren and I are going to be working together in May to do a little bit of a demo looking at constraints and approach and show jumping. Any top tips? Anything that you think would be? Not equestrian. I have a
rep. Yeah, but we aren't going to have any time. You got 90 minutes or something with two scenarios.
Yeah. I was, So I'm curious. I have got a little bit of a representative practice design tool, and I thought I could do MentiMe so that people can kind of score it. But it's like,
I mean, coming from someone who knows nothing about equestrian sports, I think I can just give you the old adage that, you know, you already know this, but it's making sure that the training or the practice that you're doing replicates the performance environment. And when I say it represents the performance environment, I don't mean it has to be one-to-one. I think sometimes people talking about binary and putting things in the boxes, people sometimes get tempted to go, this is either non-representative or representative, which I don't think is true. I think it's a continuum. I think it can be an element of representation, but you can also have abstract elements. So trying to train can be transferable to that performance environment is really important. And basically going back to what we were saying earlier, is that giving all of the riders there the opportunity to calibrate to different opportunities, different horses, different jumps, really allowing them to explore and try different things and fail, as we've been talking about, and understanding that that's not important at this point. If you're here to learn, then failure is equally, if not more important than winning and being successful. So yeah, beyond that, I mean, you're both perfectly capable of executing a fantastic session. So yeah, more power to you.
Thank you. I'm really interested you talk about that, because one of the things that I think is that experienced or professional riders do is ride lots of different horses, whereas amateurs tend to have one horse only, and a really restrictive experience.
I think
it's,
I think that's important, though. It's like, you know.
Yeah, I think it's really important.
I just very quickly on that one. For me, more and more, and this comes back to your calibration and stuff, I think, is it's allowing yourself to be in the moment.
Yes.
And,
yeah,
you know, if look, yes, one of the best things I find I can do, if I'm going to a really big competition that's pushing my boundaries, is to ride a student's horse that's not very good and I can't trust it, because it makes me focus and be in the moment. Obviously, I don't want to tip upside down and hurt myself, but it just gets you back focused and feeling what's happening, and rather than and ready for anything. Whereas if it's just predictable and perfect all the time, again, it's just really dangerous, because you won't be there, and then suddenly it's happened and you're in trouble.
Yeah, no.
You can use like a cricket analogy.
But not overplanned. It's like,
yeah, exactly. It's like you can use a cricket analogy where, you know, as a batsman, you get a good read of one bowler and like you feel really confident against that one bowler, and then suddenly you've got another bowler that comes in and gets completely on top of you, and it's like you need to practice against different environments, different actors, to really be a comprehensive player. It's not good enough to be really good against just one bowler. You need to have all of those different environments to really become a complete rider or a complete athlete.
And so I've seen that, like with tennis. Was it and you know, one of the comments was, these guys haven't seen enough of her yet to be able to read really what she's going to do, and it will be interesting in a couple of years' time. Same as cricket, you know, you start to be able to predict what they're doing because you've seen them enough, and you start to be able to counter that. And can they then handle it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll go out and have another go tomorrow and see what happens.
And you know, one of the nice things actually from the research that I'm just doing at the moment that's coming through is when I am going to nag you to do a course, so obviously you can still say no, Warren, but when the experienced riders are actually talking about that they're being meticulous in their coursework when it's closer to their limit. But what they're doing is they're looking for opportunities for being able to adapt if something goes wrong, not what it's going to exactly look like, which is really interesting. They're walking a course looking at adaptability.
Yeah. There's an element of like, where is there space in the course?
Yeah, yeah.
To take the pressure off.
Yeah, exactly. And if this happens, how do I, and if we end up here, how do I
We did a it was very privileged. They built the show jumping course from the Olympic final at the BS Center, and there were 8 of us, and Di Lampard was there, and one of the top course designers from this country. And it was just, it was fascinating to walk it, because it's just, and I think more and more at elite level, it's just on the edge. And if you, you know, they don't give you that space, and, you know, what happens here relates to 6 questions, 8 questions down the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whereas at other levels, it's, you know, 1 question at a time or whatever. And I think the same, yeah. You know, in any sport, as you're pushing into elite levels, then there's so much more information coming at you quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And but you're on the edge of your abilities.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, to what we're talking about earlier, but you've got to go to those places to develop your skills. And it's just that balance of what's a little bit too far and you scare yourself, which you might need to do sometimes, versus I feel uncomfortable, but I can learn and develop.
Yeah. And there's probably a whole load of stuff in there around what makes an environment that's a learning environment versus tipped over into the too stressed to learn for both horses and humans. And maybe how do we recognize that?
To me, that's where action boundaries become really relevant, because me that's how you quantify that. I don't think there's actually any research out that does that kind of analysis specifically for environments, but I think that would be a very worthwhile thing to do.
Maybe something Warren and I to work on in the future.
Well, then there's also what strikes me again briefly on that is people bring their perceptions in before they start something, and they've already put their boundaries in place.
Yeah.
And like sometimes one of my roles, which is, you know, difficult and you know, how do you build it into coaching, is when you ask someone to do something they don't think they can do, and they've already told you that they can't. And
they're perfectly capable of doing.
Yeah, and you've got to make a choice where you put them in that situation and go, you can. Yeah. And no, you wouldn't do it like that, but you'd almost focus them on you and get them reacting to you. But if that trust and rapport is there, often they'll have a go at it. And again, from a coaching perspective, if you make sure the ingredients are right, which is one of the good things about our sport, then the horse will fix it, which in another sport doesn't happen.
No, I remember people used to say to me, because I've had motorbikes most of my life until recently, and horses, and people used to say to me, God, horses are so dangerous. And I'm like, my motorbike won't get me out of trouble.
Yeah, no, I don't need to ride a bike because I would kill myself very quickly.
My horse goes, nah, that's a bad idea. You messed up. Let me take over.
Yeah, which is one of the beauties of the sport, because done well, it really is a team sport.
Yeah, yeah. And do you know what it made me think about this? And I'm going to have to confess, I love Strictly. And this year, one of the things I enjoyed watching was John and Johannes, because they were doing like a 2 male couple, you know. But what they did was they swapped over leadership. So they would keep swapping who was in which role. And I was watching them going, actually, this is really fascinating. This is how I think about show jumping.
Yeah.
You know, I'll lead, and then there are times when I go, okay, I'm handing over to you. Now I'm picking it back up again. Now I'm handing it over. Now I'm picking back up. And it's tiny. It's like 51%. But it's just this little pass backwards and forwards.
Completely.
And I watched it and I went, yeah, but you know, like normally in a couple dance, I go, no, that's really crap because it's that boring for a woman. But I was going, that's really interesting. That's making me think that's what it looks like, what it feels like.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good analogy. It crosses over very well.
Cool. Thank you so much, both of you. It's
a pleasure.
It's been really, really interesting. I've loved the conversation. Anything either of you would like to sort of offer as a parting comments? I mean, I think for me, I'm excited just about where we could go in terms of actually just doing more research in equestrian sports. And that really excites me. I think that's got so much potential.
I mean, briefly from my perspective, it's, I think the value is in the crossover between the sports and the, and, you know, I think one of the biggest issues our sport has got is early specialization, as in just,
both,
just a riding perspective,
yeah,
let alone, you know, like I said, with the girls playing lacrosse, it just makes such a difference to the way they ride. So it's a huge issue.
Yeah, yeah. And for the horses as well, actually, I think. Just the horses having lots of...
Yeah, no, that one's, that's a massive one too.
Yeah, yeah.
I think for me, trust that your organism or your horse can make decisions, yeah, and it's not a uniquely human trait. Yeah. And if anything, if you give them full autonomy and they are truly skilled, they're in a better position to make those decisions than you, because at the end of the day, it's their body, it's their action capabilities,
yeah,
it's their affordances. So learning to trust your horse and knowing that you dictating everything the horse does probably isn't the best thing unless it's necessary. That for me would be the take that really comes out at me from this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah. And that's the hugest issue for, you know, that how do you trust something you can't even talk to?
Yeah, yeah. And how do we coach that? How do we build that relationship?
Which, you know, you've got to get people confident to, or not confident, but they've got to trust their environment and the people they're working with to be able to come out of their comfort zone and go places that they're really challenged by.
Yeah, yeah.
Mentally, as much as physically.
Yeah. And it's a mental and emotional sport in lots of ways, isn't it? But it's also a sport that I love passionately. And I watch, you know, I listen to some of the stuff on Social License and I think I would be so heartbroken if we lost equestrian sports.
I think the biggest thing, the hardest thing, or the thing against equestrianism, and I think we touched on it earlier, is the skill set you need to be able to feel it and really take part in it is, you know, there are other, I call it an extreme sport. There are other extreme sports.
Yeah.
You know, you can jump out of a plane. That's not, it's being brave enough to take that step, but you can't, when it's done well, it looks really easy. So to comprehend it and have a sense of that relationship is, it's really difficult because you need a skill set that lets you feel it.
But I think there's so many skills in there that are so valuable in life, that just connection to another sentient being is phenomenal, and what it gives us as human beings for me is incredible. That just overlap to another being's umwelt, as it were, lived experience is amazing, and that horses, like you say, allow us to do that and actually enjoy it and autonomously, you know, for many of them, or for seeing all of them, partake is incredible.
Yeah.
My niece, I watch her on Dusky, and she has got a massive smile. It's transformed her. It's transformed her experience in school. It's transformed her confidence. You know, the way she interacts with a horse is just something so precious.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's actually really important to be almost a central focus, because it's, you know, I've seen it and heard it a lot. It's the value of that interaction and that as a core.
Yeah.
It's a hugely valuable thing.
Yeah. And relates to the rest of life, doesn't it? And the nice thing about an ecological dynamics perspective, like say James, is that it's any organism. We don't have to have different theories to think about what goes on for the horse and what goes on for the rider. We can actually look at them as a dyad. And I think that's really, hopefully will be really, really supportive of coaching going forwards.
Mm. Yep. And that'll be the next challenge, is coaches feeling supported by it as opposed to challenged by it, and then taking that into riders that don't feel like they're being attacked or...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's a huge balance, because there's some... what's a good way to put it? there's varying levels of insecurities, put it that way.
Yeah, yeah, especially, and lots of them are around, I think, you know, relationship with the horse, and then relationship, social license, and other people's expectations, and they're not wanting to let your horse down or injure it. There's like loads of complexity. Sorry, James, there's just like masses of complexity. It's more like parenting and having a relationship than it is in many ways than another sport.
You know? I would agree.
Don't tell me I can't do that with my kids, kind of thing. Yeah. And I remember you saying to people you bought the wrong boat, and they would get really, really upset about it. And I was like, geez, you know, this is hard enough when it's a piece of plastic. When you say to somebody, that's not the right horse for you.
Yep.
It's really difficult.
Yeah. No, it's a bit of a job, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow. Okay, listen, it must be beer o'clock. Thank you so much, both of you.
Pleasure.
No problem at all.
Pleasure. Nice to meet you, James.
Likewise, Warren. It's an absolute pleasure.
All right. We'll speak again.
Thank you so much, James. Yeah, brilliant. You two stay in touch, and thank you so much.
Cool.
Yeah. Good night.
Good night.
No problem at all. Speak soon. Yeah.
Cheers.
Have a beer on me.
Absolutely.
Nice.